Ladies and gentlemen, this is Jay Booksbaum. You know me probably from wine and spirits, but I want to tell you something. Even though I'm in that area of expertise, you're about to hear from Rahama Bistritsky Clapman, who runs MASS, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids. They're in their 20th anniversary. They've got over 45,000 families that they've helped over the years. It's an amazing program. It's called Family Matters. And if you've got any issues with bullying or alcohol or substance abuse or any other kind of abuse, they're your place to go. I'm really excited to introduce you all to Rahama Bistritsky Clapman here on Deb Brenner's Talk Line Communications Network every Thursday night at 9 o'clock. Listen to Rahama and Family Matters.
It's so nice to be back with Family Matters. This evening, we have on Rabbi Yanky Horowitz, and we're very honored to have you with us. Thank you for being with us, Rabbi Horowitz. Good evening.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be on with you, and it's a pleasure to continue to work with you and the wonderful work you're doing.
Thank you. And the wonderful work that Rabbi Horowitz has been doing even before MASS began 20 years ago. I'd like to go down memory lane with you, Rabbi Horowitz.
Sure.
20 years ago, I started MASS, and I remember asking you to be a guest speaker at our first event at Rabbi Rosenblatt's Shul on Avenue N and East 16th Street. And at that time, we had 27 parents come together in my home and talk about the issues they were facing with their loved ones. And we decided to do a public event so that we can educate and make aware to the community what was going on. Rabbi Ronnie Greenwald, my mentor, Oliver Shalom, he was our MC for that evening, and you were one of our first guest speakers. We had 18 speakers stand up that night, but Rabbi Horowitz, you had just started Project Yes at that time and had a helpline. I'd like to go down memory lane if you can tell our listeners this evening about Project Yes and what, you know, inspired you to do that, to make that helpline at that time, please.
Well, it was like you said, it's a long lane. It's a long lane with the memory. I got involved in all of this really through an article I wrote in the Jewish Observer, not intending to go down this whole at-risk area. I was an 8th grade Rebbe for 15 years. I volunteered to teach the weakest students in the yeshiva, and I loved every minute of it. And I just noticed that we were losing the percentage of the children, and it was just sad to see kids come up through the grades, turned off to learning and Yiddishkeit overall. And I wrote an article called An Ounce of Prevention. An average New York Times op-ed piece is like 800-900 words. This was 4,500 words. It was a small book. And I basically wrote, look, guys, we have a great school system, but there are changes we need to make in order to reach more children. And, you know, I had a very nice, quiet life in Muncie. I have a nice, busy life now. But, you know, it went crazy. I mean, my wife and I got 300-400 phone calls the first month alone. There was OHEL at the time. There were one or two other agencies. That was it. And OHEL did primarily different things. But people were calling literally nonstop. We had two phone lines at the time. It just nonstop. And, you know, some people called up and said such a wonderful person for bringing this up. And so that was like 5-10% called and said, what a horrible thing I'm doing by speaking negatively about the schools. But most of the people were just begging for help. And we got, and they may be, and I know we're dating ourselves, Rahama, but we got over 100 letters in the mail, snail mail, just from parents just begging for help. And after this had gone on for a little while, I went to Rabbi Shera Zatzal, and Rabbi Moshe Shera, and I said, Rabbi Shera, we got to do something. I'm one guy. I can't manage this. And, you know, to his great credit, he, just a few months before he passed away, the Project Yes was the last thing that he was involved, you know, that he started in his illustrious career and his great life. And we started, you know, the first thing we did was actually open a helpline so that people could call in and get help on a whole host of different areas, whatever it was that they, that they needed help with their children. You know, as time went on and other wonderful agencies opened, you went down memory lane. I remember you walking into that OHO meeting.
Yes.
I think that
we had that OHO meeting with David Mendel, and we had like 12, 15 leaders in the FRM community at the table. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. Chaim Kamenetsky was there, over Shalom. Chaim Kamenetsky over Shalom. There was some people from Tara Masara and from the Agudah. Rabbi Bloom was there with me. And David, as being the great visionary, David Mandel, the leader of OHO, the great visionary that he was, he, once the teen at risk issue became more, got more to this, became more, you know, something that was talked about more, David set up a system where every few months the different agencies would get together so that we could collaboratively work on things. And it was a fantastic idea. And I believe you asked for some time or just came in. I don't really remember.
No, what happened was, remember when you stood up at our event, you said, Rahama, I had no idea that MASC started its helpline the same day as we started the Project Yes helpline. And I remember you clearly saying that you had to shut it down after the first month, because you got 300-400 phone calls and you didn't even have enough staff, and you didn't even realize how hard, how many families were struggling at the time.
That's right.
And MASC started our helpline at that same time. We both had no idea that there was another helpline yet running.
Right. Right, and that was I didn't remember that detail, but I remember your passion, the way you spoke about the teenagers, and you know, it was inspiring listening to you, really. And that passion has driven you to do the great work you're doing all the years.
20 years later, with an amazing staff that has been with MASC from the beginning, and has just grown and grown, unfortunately, but fortunately, because there are people that need to call for referrals. There are many agencies out there today, not like when we started yet, Rabbi Horowitz, when it was only the both of us dealing with this issue. Today, Baruch Hashem, there are lots of different agencies, lots of different organizations that are forging ahead, trying to unmask our community, the FRM community, to recognize that we need to destigmatize, we need to help those families that are struggling with at-risk, with teens in conflict, with mental health issues, with schizophrenia, with bipolar, with drug addiction, with eating disorders, all these different issues, bullying, anxiety, a very big one there. Anxiety is tremendous today. Our calls come in every day with young adults, families, husbands, wives that are struggling with anxiety. And our helpline is there as a referral helpline. We also refer to therapists, doctors, rabbis, inpatient, outpatient, only when we work with an addiction therapist. But we can direct any family member that may need help in any of these areas if you call 718 758-0400 from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Rabbi Hurwitz, you mentioned the part about being a Rebbe all those years, and you have this 20 years looking back at the changes in the school systems. I'm wondering if we can go back to the preschool, elementary age school children, if we can talk about what goes on when a child has a learning disability, when there's a trauma in a child's life in those age years, when somebody young dies in one's family, Lolenu, and the child gets affected by something, or just the learning disability. Can we talk about elementary age children for prevention so that our listeners could maybe say to themselves, one minute, that may be my child. And with all your years of experience as a Manal, as a Rebbe, as an administrator, and the helpline director, executive director, if you can please discuss in detail about elementary age children and what you've seen over the last 20 years with your experience. Thank you.
Yeah, sure, of course. So, I would say, you mentioned about a death in the family, about other trauma that happens in children's lives or learning issues. I think the best thing parents can do is to be on top of things and to advocate for the children. If there is something going on in the child's life, very often when something's going on in a family, when the family unit is under stress, it's very normal that the parents or the people focus. Let's say for example, family has 3-4 children, and one of them is, God forbid, ill, or one of the parents becomes ill. So it's natural that the focus be on the person that's sick. But there are, while this is all going on, obviously the other children are deeply affected by it. I did two speeches in Flatbush, in Marine Park, this past Monday and last night. The first one was about general teenagers, and last night was about technology. If anybody's interested, we did a Facebook Live. It's on my Facebook page, which is Yaakov Horowitz. And the first evening got over 2,000 views. Last night just got 1,000 in a few hours. It's up free. Anybody, please help yourselves with the stuff you'd like to learn about. But I just met one of my students from my very first year of teaching. Okay, that was 35 years ago. I started teaching in Torah Seminary in 1982 at the right time. So this young man comes over to me, and I happen to have recognized him. He says, hi, Rebbe, I was in your class. I told him his name, and he said, wow, do you remember me? And I told him, I said, your father was ill that year, wasn't he? And he said, yes. And I said, I remember what an impact it made on me, that I asked him, he had missed a few homeworks. And this is for the listeners out there, this is the real takeaway message. So this kid missed, he didn't bring in homework a few times, and all the years I always had a policy, if I had something to say to a child, I always did it privately. Like I never ever, would dress somebody down in front of the other kids. So I said, Mordechai, could you come outside for a minute? I wanted to ask you something. So thank God I did it in private. I said, yeah, so you missed a few homeworks. So he looked at me and he said, well, my father has cancer and my mother's in the hospital every night. And Rahama, I said I was just going to get choked up now. I felt so bad. And Rabbi Schwartz, the principal of Torah Semes, I ran into that office recess time. And I respectfully, maybe it was very respectful. I was young, and I was like, how do you send me a kid without telling this to me? I said, said, Rabbi Schwartz, you got to let me know. I don't want to know if the kid didn't learn well the year before. I never got scouting reports on the kids. I'm principal. I always told the students, I don't know anything about you. You have a fresh start for real. But if there's something going on, we got to know. And he was really upset, and he said, Rabbi Horowitz, let's sit down and make a plan about it. And we started immediately from that moment forward. There was, not that a child was misbehaving, but if the family was divorcing, or there was a second marriage, or there was a family member that was ill, we started immediately. We set a policy. That's why I remember, I'm so thankful I remember many of my students, but it was really in my mind that it was so painful to me to listen to this, realizing that I had a kid in my class. How in the world could he possibly concentrate on anything else? So I think
absolutely.
The message is
I want to interrupt you, Rabbi Horowitz, and I want to.
Please, you're not interrupting me. Go.
I just want to say that we're always saying on our radio show that parents need to know they need to share with the schools.
Yep.
The kids are in school all day long. They need to know the schools are your partners. They're co-parenting from 9 to 5 in some way because they're under their guidance, under their care, and they need to know if there's something going on at home. Yes.
Right. Tell us. Right. Exactly.
Whether it's an illness, whatever it is, whether there's a lack of finances, whether there's no money to make Shabbos, and you need to make Shabbos, whatever it is, the school must know. So I'm glad you brought that up, Rabbi Horowitz.
That would be my message to parents. Yes, what's going? You know what the message to parents is. I think the message to parents is that if your family is going through something, please let the school know, and share the information with the staff because we need to be able to help. Sometimes there are some issues that are going on. Let's say, for example, if parents have a child that's heading towards a divorce or other things that they might not be comfortable sharing or other things like that. But at the very least, I used to tell the parents on Yeshiva to at least let us know that there's stuff going on in our family right now. Our child might be having some sort of stress. The other thing about what you mentioned about the learning disabilities, and this is a little bit tricky, I believe that parents should share the information with the school. Sometimes, parents are reluctant to do so because they're afraid the school's not going to take their child. But, I think it is important to share the information with the school and advocate for your child. Go for an educational evaluation. I mean, these small steps and relatively inexpensive. An educational evaluation is not cheap, but getting information early on when the children are young is so important to get early intervention. In fact, in some of the younger grades, especially preschool, very often you can get this for free. Some school districts offer, an educational evaluation that parents can get for free. An educational evaluation is like an MRI or a CAT scan on a child's learning pattern. And lacking that information, you're just groping around in the dark. When a child is not learning well, it's so hard. It's hard to figure out what it is. And there's great standardized tests that evaluators give children so they can pinpoint, what is going on. Reading, if the child is not reading well, especially in Judaic studies, that is an area that early intervention can help. Another thing I would recommend is that parents really work to see that the children get the skills that they need. Chumash, and especially Gemara. Chumash, did you see our Gemara book, any chance, our Chumash books?
Yes, I got one. Thank you. I took one for my grandson. Thank you.
Okay. So we published Beginnings. We can go to bbchumash.com or on my website, rabbihorowitz.com, to see some of the books. We published beginner Chumash books, and we just did a beginner Gemara book. It's our first year. We just finished our first year of the book, with Hashem's help, we're in 40 schools already in the first year. I mean, it basically gives kids the background and the skills that they need to learn. Very often, schools are learning by rote, where it's more repetition rather than breaking down the Hebrew words, the prefix and suffix, and the sharashim, the root words. And if the kids are learning by rote, they wind up memorizing thousands of words when all they really need to do is learn the 12, prefix and suffix. One thing that made a very powerful impact on my life is teaching, especially teaching weekly students. I saw a study, it was a study in Bar-Ilan University, before the internet and Google and all of that. Somebody took the time to analyze all the words in Chumash from Shetara and the Chumash itself, and 270 root words, Sharashim, made up 93% of all the words in Chumash. So, if you learn some words appear a few thousand times, actually. So if you learn the main words and you learn the prefix and suffix and how Hebrew language, how the leather of those pieces fit together, they have so much, they have much better chance at succeeding, when the learning gets more intensive, because they basically own it. They're able to learn it on their own.
You know, Rabbi Horowitz, you brought up that this Gemara, it reminds me that at Mask, from day one, we always do our intakes. Even if someone's 24 years old, we do our intakes from fourth grade. We bring the parents back to fourth grade and we work our way up. Because in fourth grade is when they start to learn Gemara, right? Or fifth.
Mishnah.
Right. And there are difficulties that start then, and many, many, many times, thousands and thousands and thousands of times, it starts in the elementary school issues. We have 60% of Mask's clients, over 45,000 clients in our 20 years that we've spoken to, 60% is school-related issues. So this is a very important thing that you bring up about learning Gemara, starting young, doing educational evals. Again, we have Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz with us this evening, and we are on Family Matters, 718-758-0400. You can call anytime during 10 a.m. and 10 p.m., to speak with one of our trained staff members at Mask, Mothers and Fathers Alliance Saving Kids, for any issues that you may have, whether it's be yourself, a loved one, a parent, a sibling, your spouse, someone you sit next to in shul. Write down our number, 718-758-0400. Rabbi Horowitz, so after the fourth grade, the Gemara stage, what then have you seen happen going up towards eighth grade?
So that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. And let me begin this whole, not begin, but this new segment of our Gemara discussion and learning discussion. I make you an offer, Rahama. Feel free to take me up on it. I will be delighted to come in. I'll waive my honorarium free of charge. I'll be glad to do a workshop with your Mass parent group on learning Gemara, teaching Gemara, and helping your children master Gemara. You have an outstanding offer. Just let me know. I'll be delighted to come in and give a class
to your calendar as we speak.
Okay. Can I tell you something very interesting? There's a wonderful organization, I'm sure you're aware, called Sister to Sister, that supports single divorced mothers. So, Honey Nubuza runs it, and she asked me to come for Shabbos. They have a retreat This is about a few years ago. They had 300 single mothers came for Shabbos. And she asked me to come. You know, for those who don't know, you know, my father died when I was three. My mother remarried 2 years later. So she was a single mom. She passed away a year ago. Anyway, so you know, I'm a softie for all the organizations that deal with, you know, widows or single mothers.
They're
amazing. I said, tell me when to show up. You know,
sister
whatever,
to sister,
whatever.
Rabbi Horowitz, let's give a shout out to Sister to Sister, Samcheinu. They're an amazing organization helping those there.
Yep, I spoke to them, so they're great. They do fantastic work. And by the way, if there are any single mothers listening in or you know, widows, or avail yourself of the help. It's fantastic. They do amazing work. So anyway, you know, Mrs. Zuberger was planning the Shabbos with me, and she said, what would you like to speak about? So I said, whenever I go to any sort of, you know, event like this, a Shabbos or a planning session for some sort of, you know, a help for families. So the first thing I ask myself is, who else is there? What skill sets do the other presenters have? And is there something that I can contribute that other people can? That's how my head works. Like I say, I'll do whatever you want me to do, but who else is there? So she said the name. They had four other mental health professionals, and I was the only educator. So I said, okay, so let me think what I can do that the others can't. So I said, you know what? Let's do something radical. Why don't I teach mothers how to learn Gemara with their sons? Okay, I'm sure that's something you hear. You know, a single mom, not only do they have a hard time communicating with the teenage boy, which all parents have, the kids come home from yeshiva, the moms can't, you know, most of the moms can't help with the Gemara homework once it gets beyond a certain point. And it's even socially, you come home and say, hi, sweetheart, how was your day? What did you learn today? Oh, my, you know, whatever, you know, you're not going to. So I wrote up a syllabus for a one-hour class, and it was called Becoming Your Son's Favorite Savrusa, Study Partner. And there were 300 mothers there. I prepared 30 handouts. I didn't think anybody would come. You know, I said I would just get a few people. So 150 of them, 150, half the population came to my class.
Wow.
And it lasted over 3 hours because it was, well, you know, once we started the discussion about that, a whole host of other questions came up. But I designed a program, a class, 1 hour, I can teach anyone how to learn from an Art School Gemara. Meaning with the help of an Art School Gemara, I taught the mothers how to be able to learn Gemara with their kids. And I'll be delighted to do that class for your, you know, for your parents, and also how to troubleshoot when the children don't get Gemara. You know, how to have a whole program and relevance. You know, the examples that the Gemara uses are just by nature. There's things that would taking place in the times of the Gemara, you know, the hundreds, well over 1,000 years ago. So they're taught. you might appreciate this. I started the class by asking the mothers, I said, tell me, ladies, in educational terms, it's called an introductory set, the Madeline Hunter's lesson plan style, where you spend 2 minutes introducing the like you bring something that's relevant to the subject to get people's attention. It's called an anticipatory set. So I was thinking, what should my anticipatory set be? So I said, ladies, raise your hands, please, and tell me a Gemara phrase that you heard over 50 times and you have absolutely no idea what it means. So it was really hysterical. So the women started raising their hands, and they would use it one after another, you know, different words that they heard. It was very funny. You know, what does Mamonoshef mean, and what does Grada mean, and what does this mean? And everybody pulled the room and started laughing when, you know, hey, I heard that too. You know, they were all going through these words. And then one of the women said in Yiddish, it was actually a Yiddish woman from Monroe, a Fatima woman, And she said, Rabbi Horowitz, can I ask you something? She said, in Yiddish, what is that not interesting about an ox? What's so interesting about an ox? That, you know, the Gemara talks, one of the Gemaras that the children were learning talks about damages. And one ox gores another ox, so it's another, who's responsible to pay? So she said, yeah, this is my son comes from school, he picked up the phone to learn with his study partner, his chavrusa, and he said, the ox did this, and the ox did this, and the ox did that. She said, one ox looks like the other ox. and it was total pandemonium. I lost control of the crowd. They went absolutely, I literally sat down for a few minutes, because they were laughing, and all the women were, you know. So I said, let me ask you something. Let's assume, how about you go shopping one evening in Monroe. You go you call a car service to pick you up, and you load your packages, and your wagon, when it's empty, rolls down the hill and smashes my windshield, or my headlight. Are you responsible to pay? You'll say, well, I just let go. I didn't push it. I let go. I didn't do anything. And I'll say, but letting go meant it hit my car. I said, if it's windy, would that make it more responsible for you or less responsible? You could say, it's not my fault because the wind blew it away. And I could say, well, wind would... You knew it was windy, so you should have held on more time, okay? If it tips over and eggs fall out and I slip on the eggs, that's a secondary damage. Should it more like... Anyway, so I said, do you find this interesting? She said, fascinating. Yeah, sure. I said, if I gave a class on this, would you be interested in the day, you know... She said, yes. I said, that's what they're talking about. There's oxen, and in those days, they didn't have car services and stores. They brought their animals to town, and they would mix it up in the parking lot. So listen to what she said, Rechama. It was so interesting. She was quiet for a minute, and then she said, tell me, Rabbi Horowitz, when my son's Rebbe learns with the kids, does he talk about oxen, or does he talk about parking lots and shopping carts? Does he make it interesting for the children? Or does he just talk about, you know, what the Talmud talks about, what the Gemara talks about? And I said, I hope he does wagons, and I would encourage him to talk about things that are relevant. But I said, if he doesn't, here's your opportunity. Now you could, when your son comes home from school, and he's learning something that might not be that relevant, you can sit down at the table and talk to him about making Gemara exciting and relevant for him by being a little creative, and then you'll have a point of discussion, and you'll be helping him out in the school.
Very important, absolutely. It's hard for a divorced mom or single parent to do homework with kids, especially in subjects that women don't learn or haven't learned it. So having your books and other support systems in place is so, so important. Which brings me back to that sixth grader who's going to be bar mitzvah, has to have another stressor of learning the parsha probably for his bar mitzvah possibly, and at the same time, learning Gemara, which may not come easy to him. And pressure, peer pressure from friends, how they're going to be doing it, and their families listening and watching. I'd like to talk a little bit about that, please.
It's complicated. You know, it's schooling is... For a percentage of the children, let's be perfectly honest, there is a percentage of the children for whom school is an extraordinary challenge. Some kids just don't do well sitting in a chair for a long period of time. Some kids don't do well with certain subjects. And, you know, in Judaic studies, that Gemara is a specific type of analytical logic that some kids find very challenging. It's the same with everything else. As with everything else, you know, I think to to the extent that parents can try to get their kids help earlier on, and if they see their children are struggling with their learning, like I said earlier, try to figure out what the cause of it is by doing educational evaluation. Try to get the child a tutor. Try to get somebody to learn with them if they can't. And perhaps, and this is what I really would encourage parents to do, sit down with the school head or sit down with a teacher or administrator at the school and let them know that you want your child, it's more important that they learn the skills. Maybe they could take a modified program where if the entire class is, let's say, taking a test on an entire page, an entire daf of Gemara, and you have a child that's struggling with Gemara, let them know that it's perfectly fine with you. In fact, you'd appreciate if that child could only be tested on a fraction of that, and let them know that well. You know, there are a lot of ways to skin this. You know, if there is a resource room or, and children are able to learn at their own pace, that's the best, of course. But, you know, I think parents should intervene as best they can to try to get their kids the ability to learn differently when they need to. You know, I think that's a really important piece of all this.
Yes, and I hear that in Lakewood and different areas, they are stopping the boys from leaning on Shabbos because of embarrassment, if a boy can do it as well as his friends, whether
it's... You're talking about reading at the bar mitzvah?
Yes, for the bar mitzvah, Shabbos bar mitzvah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and by the way, not just I didn't know that about Lakewood, but I'm not sure I would suggest that they do it across the board, but whatever. I mean, I always tell the parents of my yeshiva and my students, the parents of my students, that they should, you know, that they should, if their child is struggling with learning, and learning is such a big issue for them, they should make a decision as a family not to perhaps take a pass on having the child lane at the bar mitzvah. If it's a choice between having them, let's say, lane, meaning reading the Torah of the Shabbos of the bar mitzvah, that's about a year's worth of, you know, preparation, a few hours a week. You know, in the scheme of things, I would much rather them work on their skills in school. You know, it's such a killer for the kids because usually fifth or sixth grade, their day grows on both sides. They come to, they have minyan, they have prayer services in the morning, which starts their day about an hour earlier than they were when they were in fourth grade, and then they have the longer day in the evening. And then you add to that, after a 9-hour school day, to sit down for an hour a few times a week to do a pasha, it just doesn't make sense. So again, families should make that decision. And I think, from in a broader sense, I really encourage all of you listening to this to make decisions for your children, evaluating what's best for them, and turning your back on what everybody else thinks. It's such an, if your child is not succeeding in a mainstream school, and there is a school that has a much slower pace that they can succeed in, and if you make the wrong choice because you're worried about what people are going to say, there's a very severe price to pay for that. If your kid is in a yeshiva that everybody's wearing white shirts and your kid's not doing that, in high school, and when you make decisions by what's right for your children, your friends won't care. Everybody else, who cares? I always tell parents, here's my line that I tell parents. If you make decisions that are not right for your child because you're embarrassed about what other people will think, God forbid, you may or probably will wind up being much more embarrassed about much greater things down the road. If you expend all your political capital on the color of the kid's shirt, or any other social issue or learning issue. You know, then I went to the Gedolim, I went to a meeting of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah years ago. They asked me to, when back then, memory lane, you know, when the first reaction to that article, and when you started Pat Mask, and you know, when you started Patrick Gessen, and I asked the Rosh Yeshiva to encourage families to send their children to schools that are appropriate for them and not push all their kids into very high achieving high schools. And I remember, like yesterday, the Novominsky Rebbe looked at me. He said, Rabbi Yaakov, I tell it to parents all the time. They don't listen. He told this to me. Those were his words. He said, I tell this to parents, and I don't have to. He said, Rabbi Yaakov, you don't have to tell me to tell it to them. I tell it to them. They don't listen to me.
Wow.
So you have to have... I'm sorry?
I said, wow. Yes.
Yep. That was the direct quote. You know, and I see this all the time where you know, parents... Of course, we mean well, and, you know, but schools have very different programs. There are schools that are... you know, much more geared to the very high achieving schools, and parents may feel that it's prestigious to go there, or they may feel there's a better chevrah, there's a better group of kids there that have better peer influences, and they're afraid to send them to a school that has less, you know, less emphasis on academics. But this, if they're sending them to school where they can't achieve success, and there's nothing worse than that. In terms of education, I mean, they're just going to get frustrated and unhappy.
Yeah, Chanoch Benar Alpi Darko. That is what we need to remember. That we need to look at each child differently than you could have 9 children, Kanahara, and just one child may need something very different than the rest of your children. And when it's your baby of 9 children, Kanahara, it's like becomes like a personal feeling for a parent, like, what is going on? What did I do wrong? It doesn't mean that a parent's doing anything wrong. We never blame the parents. The child just may be wired differently than the 8 other children in the family. And again, we have Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz with us tonight talking about family matters, children, elementary age, and the importance of educational evaluations early on. Like the rabbi just said, Rabbi Horowitz, you mentioned educational evaluation is like an MRI of our bodies. It's an MRI of the brain where they can then evaluate and decide how to assess what is the best for our students, our children, during the early ages in elementary school. Rabbi Horowitz, I'd like to move on to talking about your involvement with victims of molestation, inappropriate touch. You wrote a book about safety. Can you talk about that for our listeners tonight?
Yeah, sure. Be delighted to. You know, I realized it just like hit me like a ton of bricks probably 15 years ago. It really hit me that a very significant percentage of the kids that we were working with had been abused as children. And, you know, I wrote it at the time, and I felt it very strongly, and I keep saying this because I think it's important for your listeners to think of it this way. The children who abandon religion, I think, or have a diminished observance level or are struggling with religion or struggling with school, we very often tend to lump them into one category, like kids who are at risk. But here's how I encourage you guys to think about it. Think of the two categories. There's one group of kids who are abandoning religion but have very nice, successful, fulfilling secular lives, or fulfilling lives with a diminished level of religious observance. Those kids, I say, they abandon religion only. they're in life, they're having a great life, they're just not keyed in religiously. The second group are kids who are abandoning life. They're abandoning religion also, but they're really abandoning life. And what that looks like is not, you know, a successful kid who's going to college and has a social life, but it's rather, you know, God forbid, cutting or suicide attempt or you know, using heroin. These are things the children are self-destructing. They're also abandoning religion, but that's a distraction from what's going on. They're really abandoning life. And those kids, I'm sure you've seen this all the years, you know, those kids have, the vast overwhelming majority has suffered from real trauma.
Yes.
So I realized that distinction at the time, and it just struck me at you know, how bad the situation was in terms of abuse. So I wrote, I started writing about it. I looked back, you know, I wrote three, you know, real straight talk articles in the Shpacha magazine over 10 years ago, 10 and a half years ago, about this issue. I wrote in the Jewish Press before then and other publications and on my website, begging people to listen, that there was a problem, you know, that people looked at us, both of us, you know, like we lost our minds when we were talking about what an issue it was. So, you know, after doing advocacy and using whatever power of persuasion I had to try to make people realize what a problem we had, I decided to, you know, focus the energy into what could we do to stop it. And that's really where I focused most of the energy of our organization over the past, you know, 10 years or so. You know, we don't do the helpline anymore. You know, you're doing it. You do great work with it. What we're doing is, you know, we're mostly doing child safety, education, prevention, the book, you know, thank you, we did this book with Art Scroll. I just wrote a small piece in Mishpacha magazine commending Rabbi Zlatowicz for having the courage to do that book 9 years ago, and it wasn't that cool to talk about it in our society. And the book is it's in three languages now. We're well over 50,000 homes. So you know, that's where we've been focusing our energy, on child safety education, and it is extraordinarily effective, and I really encourage everyone to really spend some time learning about it, all parents, and having these conversations with your children.
Yeah, your books are very effective. I know that we on our helpline recommend that parents do buy that book, all your books, actually. And I do want to remind our listeners that molestation does not always start with an act of inappropriate touch. There is an issue before that is called grooming. And I wanted you to talk about that, please, the grooming before something drastic can happen, please.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the things, you know, there's tons of research, you know, to support this, and it's just anecdotally, if you just look around or at these situations, what happens is almost always there is a grooming process where the abuser, slowly encroaches on the private space of the children. It could be physically, it could be emotionally, meaning that, the backstory is that abusers are, you know, only a tiny percentage are children that they don't know. The vast majority are children they do know. And what's going on in the abuser's mind, these evil and brilliant people, they're great at figuring out which children they could abuse and get away with it. And that's why child safety education works. And everybody wonders, how can you train a 40-pound kid to defend themselves against a 200-pound adult? Once you understand why it works, that's why whenever I do my classes, I always try to empower the parents to realize how effective this stuff is. So the key is to understand how the predators think. The predators are looking for children who have not been spoken to, who were not trained, who did not have child safety education, who don't know what the norms are. And they do things to find out. That's what the grooming process is, to get closer to the children. They'll, let's say, for example, let's talk physically. Rather than just starting, you know, going 0 to 60, grabbing a child and molesting them, which happens, but it's very rare, they're much more likely to, like, put a hand on their shoulder, you know, put a hand on their back, and see how the children react. A child that's been spoken to will turn around to the... They might say something, they might not, but you'll see it in their eyes that they're starting to get uncomfortable. And the abusers typically step back from those kids because they are afraid that, uh-oh, this kid was spoken to, I'm going to get myself arrested. So that's why that stuff works. So by speaking to your children and having them understand what's appropriate and what's not, the abusers self-select. They're not going to be interested in starting up with your kids. So it's family relations. You know, it's they're afraid of children who have been spoken to, meaning who have got child safety education, and they're afraid of children who have close relationships with their parents. Those are the two real factors.
Yes. I know that we get calls on our helpline daily. I'm sorry to report to our listeners, but daily, about families that are questioning whether they're a teen at risk or teen in conflict, wasn't molested at any time, and not teen, I'm sorry, whether their child could be a 35-year-old, it could be a 19-year-old daughter, it could be a 29-year-old son, it could be a teenager that's acting out of the family's values differently, change of clothes, self-medicating, self-mutilating, eating disorders. And they're questioning whether or not their child may have been molested. And I want to bring up the idea of parents saying if it happened only once to a child when they were 7, 9, 17, in camp, at home a babysitter, a sibling, it happened only once, a father said to me, why is my daughter acting out for so many years if it happened only once? So can we speak about the effect of that one time that it may have happened to them?
Yes, yeah, so first of all, you're asking, you know, Muhammad, you speak with the wisdom of experience and the wisdom of listening to this for so many years and helping so many families. I think the important, the first thing that struck me when you said once, my response to that parent would be, they told you about once. How do you know it wasn't 50 times and they only said once? You know, even when children disclose that something happened to them, they very often are uncomfortable enough giving all the information. It usually comes out in dribs and drabs. It doesn't usually, get disclosed all of it. So the fact that a child said it happened to them once is not proof positive that it was only once. But even if it was once, it undermines their safety. You know, I encourage your listeners to do a Google search for Abraham Maslow's A Hierarchy of Needs. And, you know, his work was very instrumental in my dealing with teens at risk and dealing with my students. You know, Maslow says basically that there are, you know, 5 levels of human needs, and lacking a lower level doesn't allow you to get to a higher level. So safety is the second, physical needs is the first, thing comes safety. And after that comes family and self-actualization. And Maslow would say that if a child is not feeling safe, they're not able to go on with their lives. And, you know, especially if the abuser was someone who should have been protecting the child, they just, many of them just never, ever feel safe again. And it's just a horrible thing. I mean, how would, I tell parents, like, how would you feel if our car broke down in a terrible neighborhood? You know, the fear for our lives then, at that moment, crowds out anything. You're not interested in anything anybody has to say. You're not interested in your friends. You're not interested in anything. You just want to get home. So when children perpetually feel this way because they were violated by someone, someone close to them, they just can't feel safe again. So that once, you know, getting mugged once, just think of it that way. Think of it that way. Imagine if somebody was imagine if someone was walking to the park. Tell, you know, imagine someone's walking to a parking lot and they get jumped by two people who beat them up and steal their car and leave them there bloody, you know, bloodied and bruised. And now how, that any time they walk to a parking lot for the rest of their life, they're going to be afraid to some level. So they,
yeah.
I mean, they can't function. So that's what children feel like. And so once is, getting mugged once is a big deal. So
it's a big deal,
much,
Rabbi Horowitz. A very big deal. And it's an imprint on their brain forever. And that is why we need professionals to educate our listeners a bit more about this topic. And we are going to have on professionals in the future show, on the future shows, on Family Matters about this topic. Rabbi Horowitz, we can talk for many hours. We've done so many programs together, and we want to continue to have you on our show and speak. But time is running out. And if anyone has any questions, you can email me at Ruchama, R-U-C-H-A-M-A, at maskparents.org. Our number is 718-758-0400. And Rabbi Horowitz, I want to thank you for being on our show tonight. I want to thank you for sharing with our listeners. Go buy Rabbi Horowitz's books. They're very helpful. I want to thank you, Rabbi Horowitz, very much. Any last words?
My greatest pleasure. I just want to tell you folks that it's not just, you don't have to buy, you don't have, it's nice if you buy the book, but there's a free video. We have a free video online. It's 9 minutes and 40 seconds. Just do a Google search for Yaakov Horowitz, Child Safety. It'll come right up. It's a free video that will explain to you everything you need to know about speaking to your children. So, you know,
thank
there are lots
you.
Of free resources out there. Thank you, Ruchama. Be well.
Yes,
and
thank
tomorrow
you.
I'll have to stand.
Have a good
Listen.
Evening. And have thank a you, good
Shabbos.
Well.
Thank you.
It'll
be great work at Shabbos.
In case you missed our interview with Yoli Friedman, CEO of Credit Capital, you can still take advantage of their unique services as featured on the radio. Whether you're looking to invest in a business, do some construction on your home, or repay high-interest debt, Credit Capital can assist you with up to $250,000 at 0% interest from 12 to 21 months. How do they do this? Traditional loans require you secure their money with either collateral or at least 2 years of income statements. Credit Capital will utilize your personal credit to apply for personal credit from popular banks such as Chase, Bank of America, Capital One, and others to secure your credit. Credit Capital is not a credit repair service, but helps you if you have made timely payments, even if you have a low score, to obtain funds for your personal or business use. They've helped hundreds of people in the community and would love to help you. For more information and a free consultation, please call 212-321-0333. That's 212-321-0333 or online at creditcapitalny.com. Mention this program for a 10% discount. That's 212-321-0333. Credit Capital to help you.
KZN, Talk Line Communications Network Radio, America's number one Jewish program.
Did you ever consider hosting your own radio or television show? We can help you get on the air. Talkline Communications works with broadcasters as well as with TV and radio stations in New York and nationwide that lease time, all at competitive rates. We work with doctors, lawyers, and other professionals, as well as with ethnic broadcasters. For more information about hosting your own radio or TV show, please call 212-769-1925. 212-769-1925. And out of New York, call 1-866-MY-TV-SHOW. That's 1-866-MY-TV-SHOW.